Hi, everybody. I'm Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm not Vince and Pat. We're going to do this a little bit different than the other workshops because there's two of us. I'm going to talk a little while about just generally about some different kinds of amends that I have done. And I don't have the insight that all these other speakers have into their lives. Everybody's so articulate and so in tune with themselves. I don't have any of that, but I will share my experience with you. And then Vince is going to get up and talk about financial amends, which I'm sure you're all just dying to hear. Ralph isn't here. What happened to him? Anyway, I'm just saying. Okay. Oh, way in the back of the room, yeah. That's smart. I really believed when I first got sober that I hadn't hurt anybody but myself. You know, I really, honest to God, believed that. I didn't think I owed. I'd hear you talking about making amends, and I'd sit in my seat and I'd think seriously to myself, "No, I can't really think of anybody that I hurt." And the truth of the matter is, if I knew you for 5 minutes, I'd probably hurt you. Because I am, as the big book describes, as has been described here by every speaker that's been talked here so far, I have always just thought about myself. It's always been just about me. And so I was, as the big book also describes, like a tornado running through people's lives. It was all about me. It took me a long time into sobriety to really get that, to really hear that. Like everybody, had a little list of amends to make, which came from my fourth step. More names got added to that weren't actually in my fourth step. But I got this list, and I'm perfectly willing to, you make a list. That's one step. Okay. Now you gotta take a breather, you know what I mean, and rest and think about it and prepare to actually make amends. And then my sponsor says, "All right, let's pick one off that list and get started." And so I picked, and I recommend doing this. I looked at that list, and I didn't really want to touch any of them, but there was one person on there, which was my father. My parents were divorced when I was 6 years old, and I owed amends to my real father. We had never been particularly close over the years. We'd see each other a couple of times a year. But when I was, 21, I was 18, 19. What difference does it make? I was 19. I had just gotten divorced from my first husband, and I needed a job. I had secretarial skills, but I'd never actually had a job, and it's hard to get the first job, you know. So I asked my dad, who was vice president of a trucking company, if he'd get me a job there. He was reluctant. I remember he said, "You know, I don't know, honey. I feel a little awkward about hiring a family member." He should have listened to his instincts, but he let me talk him into it. And so he said, "I'll give you a job as a secretary for a year." But he said, "I really think after the year that you should leave, that you should move on, because I really am uncomfortable about this." I was grateful for the opportunity. It was a good job. It would give me a good solid year on a resume to, get me started in the working world. So I was glad for it. So I went to work there. The problem is, I'm an alcoholic, and I behaved, let us say, badly there. I'm the kind of alcoholic woman who, I'm friendly. And so I got real friendly with a lot of those truck drivers. And my father sort of noticed what was going on here. And he called me one day, and he tried to talk to me about me. And I don't know about you, but when I'm in the middle of my drinking, and I can't look at any of this because I can't. It's too painful to look at. Part of the story is, I said some really ugly things to him on the phone that day. The end result of which is, we didn't really speak again for many years until after I got sober and made amends to him, which I'm about to tell you about. Except when we would see each other at weddings and funerals, we would speak, but only in the, just as necessary. And so now I'm sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've got this amends list, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, Daddy would be a good one to start with. He's kind of a spiritual guy, and I knew that whatever lame attempt I made at this would be well received by him because he's just that kind of a guy. And so, all right, I'm ready. So he's taking me to lunch this particular day, and I get in the car. I was working in Hollywood at the time. He picked me up at my office, and we're driving to the restaurant, and I'm trying to think of how to start this conversation. I just can't get there, and then we're in the restaurant, and now I'm almost ready. I almost got my head around the right words, and then the waiter would come by and sort of interrupt, and I couldn't do it. And now we're in the car driving back to my office, and I'm thinking, I got to do this. I have to do this. This is like the easiest one on my list. If I don't do this one, I'm sunk. And so we pulled up in front of, I worked at the corner of, I can't remember if it was Sunset and Vine or Hollywood and Vine, but it was a major, major busy intersection. And he pulled up double parked so I could jump out of the car, and I said, Dad, I need to talk to you. And he kind of got that it was important, and he pulled into a parking lot and parked the car, and we talked. And I told him that I knew that I hadn't been a very good daughter to him and that I had caused him a lot of embarrassment and grief when I, particularly, when working for that company with him, and that I was sorry about that, and that I, you know, I was going to try to be a better daughter from that point forward, and so that began. And as I had expected, he was very receptive to this, you know, kind of a thing, and he was very warm and very loving, and it really set me off sort of on the right foot. You know, it gave me some inner encouragement to go on to a harder one. And I'll just to tell you to go a little further with that particular. A number of years later, when Vince and I were married, we were buying our first house, and I called my dad and asked him if I could borrow some money to help with the down payment, and he loaned it to me, and he said, I don't remember, I think it was several thousand dollars, I don't remember exactly how much, but he said, you don't have to pay it back right away. I know it's hard when you buy a new house. You have other expenses, so, you know, get a little breather, and then you can start paying it back. Okay, fine. And so we borrowed the money. Now I'm thinking, as soon as I have $500 together in a chunk, I'll send him a payment. Well, I never could seem to get $500 together in a chunk somehow, you know. And he never said ever said a word about it. But every time I talked to him, it was in the back of my mind, and it bothered me. And it finally, sitting in a meeting one time, hearing somebody talk about making amends, it occurred to me that I didn't need to wait till I had $500 together. I maybe could just send him some money. And so I sent him, I don't know, $25 or something. And immediately, the way that I felt when I talked to my father changed. Immediately it changed. And, of course, eventually I got that money paid off. And so that was my first, you know, foray into the amends world, and it did give me encouragement to go on to something, you know, a little more difficult. let's see, where will I go next? When I got sober, I was married to my second husband. For those of you who are keeping, I'm just to let you know who I am. I am now married to my third and, as I like to say, final husband. But I was married to my second husband when I got sober, and we had a terrible relationship. We'd been married for, I don't know, eight or nine years, maybe when I got married, or maybe a little bit less. And I, even though I was married to him, I was still being a friendly girl. And so we had a bad marriage, and it was completely and totally my fault. There was some violence in our marriage. I don't know why I'm talking about this. I guess maybe somebody needs to hear it. There was some violence in our marriage, and I never think there. Don't misunderstand this. I never, ever, ever think there's a good reason for a man to hit a woman. However, let me just say this: when I got sober and started behaving differently, the violence in my home stopped. So I always kind of like to toss that out from time to time to the victims in the room. Because I'll tell you, if you're feeling like a victim, you're sunk. You know, if somebody else alluded to this earlier, if the problems in my life are your fault, there's nothing I can do about it. But if they're my fault, you know, there's hope because I can change. I can do something about it. I can take these steps. I can make these amends. I can change my life. If it's your fault, what can I do? And so, anyway, so I'm in this terrible, terrible marriage. I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and He was very resentful that I was coming to AA. He actually thought that I was coming to AA to meet men, which wasn't necessarily a bad guess. I mean, I wanted to be sober, but let's face it, there's a lot of men in AA, and some of you looked good to me. None of you were looking back at me, which hurt my feelings quite a bit. I never had any trouble attracting men in the bars, and now I'm sober in AA, and I really thought it had something to do with alcohol. That I didn't know, you know, I just had lost my charm when I quit drinking alcohol. I didn't get it at all. And so it made me mad that he was accusing me of something I wasn't actually doing right at that minute. And never mind that it's not my fault that I'm not doing it, you know. And so I felt really, really sorry for myself. And I thought that I had the saddest life of anybody who ever came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a crier. I think there's two kinds of people who get here, criers and people who are angry. And it's all kind of the same emotion. It's just how you, you know, express it. And I was a crier. So I cried at every meeting I went to and felt so sorry for myself and would tell my sad tale of woe to anybody who would pause for 10 seconds. I would tell you how tragic my life was and how awful my husband was. And if you had my life, you'd want to drink too. And poor me, poor me. And so with an attitude like this, it was inevitable, of course, that I would meet a man in a meeting who looked good to me, who looked back. And this momentous occasion occurred when I was around 10 months sober. The gentleman in question was about 10 minutes sober. I saw him when he came in the room the first time. I can see him like it was yesterday. He had a shaved head and a Fu Manchu mustache. My heart started to pound. I leapt across a couple of rows of chairs to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed. And she did that thing sponsors do, you know, and I went over there, and she said, "Let's not forget you're a married woman, Pat." I said, "Yeah, but I am so unhappy." And she said, "Nonetheless, you're married. And as long as you're married, I expect you to act married." I said, "This isn't a problem. I'll get divorced." And she said, "No, we in Alcoholics Anonymous don't feel like it's a good idea to make major moves in our first, this is my life we're talking about, in our first year of sobriety. So you just stay married and act married." Well, I was obsessed with this man. Again, somebody alluded to this earlier. Why would God get this guy sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? You know? Only an AA would heads nod when you say a ridiculous thing like that. So we began the little death dance, as I call it now, which is, you know, brushing up against each other in the coffee line and the meaningful glances across the room. And then he's walking me to my car after the meeting, and then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting. And it was a little bit complicated. We couldn't go to my place. I'm a married woman. He's a newcomer. He doesn't have a place. Doesn't matter, though. You know, I'm telling you, alcoholics can make anything happen. And if you work real, real hard at it, you can almost convince yourself that it's God's will. That part's a little harder, I got to admit. But so I was working at the time in Hollywood at this record company, and he was working in Hollywood also, very conveniently, at a porn bookstore. And you can't make this stuff up, you know? And so I arranged this long lunch hour one day at work for somebody to cover for me, and I went and he didn't have a car either, so I went and picked him up at the bookstore, and we went to this motel on Sunset Boulevard and spent some time together. And I dropped him off at the bookstore, and you know, in the afternoon there, and it occurred to me in the car there that I was behaving exactly the way I'd always behaved. I'd been sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 months or however long it was, hearing you say that I was going to have to change everything about the way I was living my life, or I was probably going to drink and die. You know, I'm not sure what I was thinking during those 10 months. I believe something along the lines of it didn't quite apply to me exactly or something like that. But I knew that day in the car that it did, and I was scared. I was really scared because the truth of the matter is I never wanted to be that kind of a woman. I always wanted to be somebody people would admire and respect, and I meant to be a regular person, you know, grow up and get married to the same person and get married and stay married to that same person forever and have some kids and go to church and the PTA or whatever. You know, I meant to be a regular sort of person, and I'm sober, and I always blamed it on the fact that I was an alcoholic, and now I'm sober in AA, and I can't do it. And I had no hope that it could change, because I'm sober in AA. I'm taking these steps to the best of my ability, and here I am doing the same old stuff. And I was also afraid to tell my sponsor what I had done, because she had been quite clear in her direction about this guy. But I did that night. I pulled her aside. Well, more to the point, I knocked her down when she came through the door, sobbing hysterically, "I have to talk to you right this second." And I told her what I'd done. And she said, you know, Pat, I don't think you're a woman who can cheat on her husband and stay sober. And you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to. Okay, I've just finished telling you. I've never wanted to live that way. I don't get it, you know. She suggested to me that a day at a time I was to make amends to my husband. That a day at a time I was to act as though I were a kind and loving wife. Just pretend that I loved him. I was not to discuss my latest infidelity, or for that matter, any of my infidelities with him. He did not know about most of them. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, is very clear on what I think of as these difficult amends. It says right there in the step, you can't make direct amends when to do so might injure that person or others. That's very clear that you can't go confess infidelities that they don't know about just to clear your conscience, because, in fact, making amends doesn't have anything to do with clearing my conscience. It has to do with making things right. And she said the only way you're going to ever possibly make things right is to pretend for now that you're a kind and loving wife. She said to me, I don't know what's going to happen to your marriage down the road. Maybe you're going to have to walk away from this husband someday. But I can guarantee you that if you stay there today and act as though you're a kind and loving wife, if in fact you do have to walk away from the marriage somewhere in the future, you'll be able to do it with no guilt, because you will have made amends to him a day at a time. No guilt is the only part of that sentence that got my attention, and because I had plenty of guilt. I had cheated on him from the first week we were married, and so I became willing to try. The first direction she gave me was to, every day when I went home from work, I was to ask him how his day had been and look at him and listen while he told me. The first night I did it, he looked a little surprised that I was inquiring. But he told me something that had happened to him at work that day, something about some guy at work, and I didn't know the people he was talking about. It wasn't, my direction was to listen for a minimum of 10 minutes. So I'd kind of check my watch and ask the question, and he told me about whatever it was, and when the 10 minutes were up, I left the room. And, you know, we had the same fight that night that we always had before I went off to a meeting, because we always fought before I went to a meeting, and so we had that same old boring fight. But that night in the car driving to the meeting, I wasn't crying like I usually was. And I know today, I didn't get it then, but I know today that the reason I wasn't crying is because I was finally busy in the solution. You know, when I get busy in the solution to the problem, it doesn't matter what the state of the problem might be. Because once I take my focus off of the problem, I feel better. You know, I just feel better. It took me a long time to see that. Time went by. You know, it always sounds real fast when you're talking about it like this, but months, maybe a year, I don't know how long. And I was on my knees one night saying my prayers, which were really, really short in those days. In the morning, dear God, please help me stay sober today, amen. And at night, dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today, amen. I was on my knees that night saying that prayer, thank you for keeping me sober today, amen. And I started to get up, and I realized I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it hadn't happened that day. I had been comfortable. I remember thinking, wow, it must have been yesterday, but I was comfortable yesterday too. I don't know when. This is the biggest problem in my life, as I saw it at the time, and I didn't even notice when it left. Again, I know today the reason I didn't notice when it left is I had taken my focus off of the problem a long time before that. I got back down on my knees that night, and I thanked God for this new feeling, whatever it was. And I said, I believe if you mean for me to stay married to this man, I could do that and stay sober, and thank you. And not long after that, we found out that he had cancer. And my immediate reaction to that, because this is who I am, selfish and self-centered, is, boy, I wish this would have happened when I hated him. See, it's all about me. It's all about, this is going to hurt now. This is going to hurt me. He was sick for a year and a half, and he did die. And it was a hard year and a half, but up to that point, it was the hardest year and a half of my sobriety. But it was also the best year and a half of our marriage, by about a million miles over the next best year and a half, you know, because by the time he got sick, I had been pretending to be a kind and loving wife long enough to have become a kind and loving wife, and for him to believe that I was a kind and loving wife. So he knew in that last year and a half that I was there because I wanted to be there, not just because he was sick and needed me to be. I can tell you, I am so, so grateful that I stayed there when all of my best judgment suggested that I should leave the marriage. Here's how I think. I should get out of this marriage while I'm still young and have my looks. I'm a little shallow, I'm sorry to say. I'm so grateful that I stayed because I, not only would I have missed that whole last year and a half, which was unbelievable, but I think of sponsored direction as having a ripple effect. If you're like me, if your sponsor gives you a direction when you're 10 days sober, let's say, and you do it, by the 12th day sober, you want to feel some result, you know, by the 15th day at the latest. It doesn't work that way for me. My experience is that my sponsor gives me a direction when I'm 10 days sober or 10 years sober or 30 years sober, whatever it is, I incorporate that action into my life, and it's going to have some benefit or some effect, if you will, somewhere down the road that I cannot possibly see on the day that I'm getting that direction, that my sponsor can't even really see. And that was true with this direction with my late husband, because not only did I get that great last year and a half, but Vince and I are married today. We're married 27 years, and we have a great life. And I'm not like the best wife in the world, but there's no question that the tools I learned there with my late husband have stood me in very good stead in this marriage. I know I am a much, much better wife to Vince than I ever would have been had I divorced that man. I know that to the bottom of my soul. I know that to be true. So, you know, I try to remember that when I get a direction that I don't much care for, that I never can see the whole big picture. You know, I just see the little part that's right in front of me that's troubling me right at this minute. I never see, you know, how it might, and I don't think it's my job to see that. You know, we see it when we see it. Biggest problem when I got sober. Well, let me talk about this other one first. People often ask me about making amends to people who are dead or that they have no idea where the person might be. And I don't actually have any experience with somebody who died, but I have experience with somebody that I don't know how to find. And this is, I'll tell you this story because I think this is this worked very well for me. When I was drinking, I worked at this company for a while where there were about 30 secretaries, and we were all in one big room, and I sat next to this one girl that nobody liked. She was really a pain in the ass, and I didn't really like her either, but I sat right next to her, so I was probably nicer to her than anybody else. And believe me, it's not because I'm a nicer person. It's just because she sat there, and it was just easier for me to be nice to her. So she got engaged, and she asked me to be a bridesmaid in her wedding. And I actually remembered thinking how sad that was that she would, I mean, we weren't friends outside of the office. And I thought, God, that's really sad that she doesn't have anybody else closer to her that she would ask. She had her sister and me. And so I said yes. And so the day of the wedding is drawing near, and her aunt called me one day and said, I want to throw a surprise shower for this girl. Could you give me the names and addresses of the other girls in the office? So I gave her that information, and the invitations went out for the surprise shower. And the night of the shower came. The shower was in Woodland Hills. I lived in Long Beach at the time. That's on a good night with no traffic. That's easily an hour's drive. That night with rain and rush hour traffic and whatnot, you know, it just seemed like more than a person should have to do. And I thought, well, I'll stop and get a drink at this little local bar around the corner from where I live, and maybe the rain will die down a little bit. And yeah, right. And so I went in this bar, and at some point I called the aunt, and I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm having car trouble, and I'm not going to be able to make it, and I'm just sick about it. This is, of course, with the jukebox playing in the background, and, you know, continued to drink that night. And the next day I went into work, and everybody's there at work, sitting at their desk, and the bride-to-be came in the room, and she stood in the middle of the room, and she said to everybody, I want to thank everybody here. My aunt threw a surprise shower last night, and not one single one of you showed up. Now, I don't know how the other girls in that room felt, but I can tell you I didn't feel very good about it. I wanted to kill myself. I felt so awful that I was her bridesmaid, and I didn't show. I can't even describe to you how awful I felt. I'll tell you, that was such a bad memory to me that when I did my inventory That was not in there. I mean, I locked that out of my mind completely. Until I was sober about 3 years, and I was down at my mother's house one day, and she was cleaning out some old things, and she said, I think I have some pictures that are yours, and she pulled out a picture of this wedding party. And it was like a knife in my heart. I thought, oh, my God, it's awful what I did to that poor girl. And now I don't even remember her first name, let alone her maiden name or her married name. Or I would have no way in the world to find this girl, no way whatsoever. How do you make amends for that? How do you do that? Well, I'm a member of the Pacific Group in West Los Angeles. It's a big group. We get about 850 regular members at our Wednesday night meeting. And people are always getting married and having wedding showers and baby showers. And I thought, showers are not something that I really much care for. I just don't much care for gatherings of women. I like them better today than I did, but I didn't like them at all then. But the thought occurred to me that maybe this was something I could do. Maybe I could just, bite the bullet, so to speak, and show up for these showers that occur in my group, appropriately dressed with an appropriate gift and a smile on my face, and act as though I'm having a good time. And so I started doing that. And it felt right. I knew that this was something that I could do, and it felt like the right thing to do. And, time went by, some years went by, and I'm doing that. And one night, there's a shower for this girl, and it's raining, and it wasn't close to where we lived, and I'm just kind of grousing to myself about, oh, man, I got to go to this damn shower, and it's cold. I don't want to go out. I'd rather be home. And besides, I haven't seen her at anybody else's shower. I don't even know why she's having a shower. She never shows up I'm really justifying in my mind here why it would be okay not to go to this. The whole time, as I'm doing this in my head, I'm getting dressed, of course, and brushing my hair, and I'm driving over to the shower, really pissed off that I'm going to this thing. And, oh, I'm so glad I was there. There were, I think, 4 people there that night. I remember sitting there thinking that God brought me right to that place. This is maybe the one I was intended to be at. I actually, nobody quite knew what to do because there were so few people there. So I actually was the person who sort of, and I really hate this, but like games that women know about this, games that you do at showers, I actually organized some of them and said, why don't we do this one? And I'm thinking, oh, just shoot me. I don't want to do this. But it got at least the 4 of us talking to each other, I thought for me, that felt so good when I was driving home. See, I'm thinking still it's all about me. It must have been 3 or 4, maybe 5 years later, that girl asked me to give her a cake one night for her birthday, and I did. And she got to the podium, and she said, a number of years ago, when I got married, there was a wedding shower, and Pat has no idea how much it meant to me that she was at that shower that night. It isn't all about me. I always think it's all about me, but it doesn't have anything to do with me. Nothing. The other big amends, big, that I had to do when I got sober was my stepfather. My mother married my stepfather when I was 8 years old. There was stuff going on in my house that shouldn't have been going on. I hated him. I had good reason to hate him. I don't see this as a problem when I get sober. I don't live in that house anymore, so the problem, as I see it, is gone. I hate him, but I don't see that as a problem. The longer I was sober, though, the more I would hear, let me just say this. It was one of the big secrets I was never going to tell anybody. I never had told anybody. I sat in the psychiatrist's office for the better part of the year, never told him, because I couldn't. I felt such shame. I felt so awful about it. I couldn't. I knew that story was going to my grave. I did write about it in my inventory, and it was, somebody said, to write the worst thing down first. I think Bill said it to you, to write the worst thing down first, that, the biggest, darkest secret, write it first, and then the rest will come. My sponsor didn't tell me that, so I'm sitting there with my pen trying to write my inventory, and I couldn't even think, because all I could think of was this big, terrible thing that I'm, of course, not going to write down. So I'm trying to get past that so I can write this other stuff, and I couldn't write a word. I finally decided, okay, I'll write this big secret down, but I'll just never tell it to anybody. I just won't read that part of the inventory. Well, of course, I read that part of the inventory. And now the day has come when my sponsor says to me, of all things, you need to make amends to him. I said, I think maybe you've forgotten the details. Let me refresh your memory here. If somebody is making amends here, it's not me, it should be him. And she said, well, he's not in AA, and I'm not his sponsor. And we don't really care what he's doing. We care about you staying sober, and you got a big, huge resentment here, and you need to get rid of it. And I resisted this idea as long as I possibly could resist the idea of making amends to him. But it seemed to me that every meeting I went to, after that conversation with my sponsor, that every meeting I went to, the leader or the speaker or whoever would lean right into the microphone, stare directly at me, and say something like, resentments kill alcoholics, most particularly justifiable resentments. And I'd sit in my seat there just sweating, thinking about it, and I knew I had to get rid of it, but I just couldn't see that making amends was the answer. I mean, this is just too big a leap for my mind. But I knew I needed to get rid of the resentment, so I remember sitting on my couch one day and saying a prayer, and I said, God, I want to get rid of this resentment. I really do, but I don't know how. Please take it away, and nothing happened. My experience is that nothing ever happens if all I do is say a prayer. God's there, and God's listening, but my experience is that I need to say the prayer, and then I need to get up and do whatever the footwork is, and there's always footwork. And so I talked to my sponsor about it, and she said, you really do need to go out, and you need to have a talk with him. And so I drove out to their house. They lived about 50 miles away at the time. I drove out there, and I said, I need to have a little talk with you. So we went out in the yard, and I said something along the lines of, you know, I know that I got a little ahead of myself here. I didn't see what I had to make amends to him for. I mean, as I said, he clearly was the wrong person here. My sponsor had pointed out to me that I had by now, because I was sober several years by this time, that I had by now been making daily living amends to my mother for all the grief and the anguish and the worry and the stuff that our parents go through when we're practicing alcoholics. I tormented my mother with that stuff. I love my mother. I'm sorry that I did that to my mother. I was sorry when I was doing it, and I certainly was sorry when I got sober. I hate my stepfather. What do I care if he was a little bit worried, you know? But my sponsor said, he was living in the house at the same time you're causing your mother all that grief. Just take the same little list of sins, if you will, and start there. And so I said to him, you know, I know that I caused a lot of trouble when I was a teenager living here and, you know, drinking and causing all the worry and sleepless nights and blah, 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 you know, and I'm sorry, and I'll try to be a better stepdaughter from this point forward. And I left right away. It was a little bit longer than that, but not much. And I left right away because I knew if I stayed there another minute, I was going to wander off into discussing his shortcomings. And the big book is very clear that that's not our job. And I somehow knew that if I did that, I was going to have to start all over again from scratch. And believe me, I did not want to have this conversation twice. So I kind of spit out what I had to say and I left. And I'm driving back to my house and I thought, these steps don't work. I've made my amend, and I still hate him. Well, I hadn't exactly made an amend. I had made the announcement that the amend was coming, and the announcement's important, but the actual amend was that part about being a better stepdaughter. I wasn't sure when I came to that realization, I wasn't actually sure that I could do it. I started listening to people in Alcoholics Anonymous, how they treated their parents, and just soaked up whatever I could. The first thing that I did is that whenever I called my mother, if he answered the phone, instead of saying, hi, let me talk to Mom, I would say, hello, how are you? And then let me talk to Mom. And then I thought, well, I didn't. Anytime I say I thought, it usually means somebody said to me, okay, just to be clear. It's an honest program. Somebody suggested to me that a kind and loving daughter might actually chat with him a little bit too. So I actually had to think of topics of conversation before I dialed the phone. I was so uncomfortable talking to him. So I think of these as generic topics, you know, nothing really important. If I'd seen a movie that week, that was a good topic. The Olympics were in Los Angeles right during this time, and that was good. I used that one for weeks. So I'd call and he'd answer and I'd say, hello, how are you? And he'd respond. And then I'd say, so we saw this movie this week. It was about yada yada. And he'd respond. And then I'd say, oh, and then we went to the Olympic track thing. And blah, blah, blah. And he'd respond, and now I'm just drenched in sweat by now. You know, I'm so uncomfortable. And then I'd ask to speak to Mom. You know, it might not sound like a big deal to you as I'm telling it, but it was a huge deal when I was doing it. And then Christmas was coming up that year, and by now I had shared a little bit about this with some of my friends in the program, and one of my friends said, you know, a kind and loving daughter would not rush out on Christmas Eve and pick up a shirt or a tie and have the store wrap it. You know, she might actually put a little more thought into a gift. And so I thought, okay, that's true. So I thought about what I could get, what he was one of those, some people are just hard to buy for, you know, they don't have hobbies, they don't do, you know, and I sat on the couch and I asked God to give me a little inspiration. I said, I'm totally willing to do something that he might like or use or appreciate, but I have no idea what that is. God, you got to help me out here, give me an idea. And nothing happened. Then it occurred to me, maybe I should get off the couch and go to a mall and where stuff was, you know. And so I did that, and I was walking around, and it was in this needlepoint shop, and there was this thing on the wall to needlepoint about fathers and daughters, just a sickening little saying about fathers and daughters. And I thought, there is no way. But I bought it. I did it. Those of you women who know, needlepoint takes a fair amount of time. I did my nicest work. I framed it nicely, took it over there, gave it to him. There was a moment when he opened that, just a moment, here and gone, this fast, where he got a tear in his eye. And it was absolutely a spiritual experience. It was so powerful. I knew in that here and gone instant that if I kept trying to do what I was trying to do, trying to act as though I were a kind and loving daughter, that God was going to make this resentment bearable enough I would not have to drink over it. I knew it. I absolutely knew it. I kept doing things like that. Remember one year Vince and I had gone to Yosemite, and when I was a kid, right after he married my mother, he took us on a vacation to Yosemite. It was maybe the happiest memory of my childhood. We hiked, we laughed, we camped. It was fantastic. I have this wonderful memory of us hiking up. And I was like 8 years old, so I was small. But I remember us hiking up to Vernal Falls. And because I was small, I was tired. And he picked me up and put me on his shoulders. And he was singing. And it was just this fabulous memory. And so we were in Yosemite, and there's an Ansel Adams studio there. And I bought this picture of Vernal Falls. And I gave it to him. And on the card that accompanied the gift, I wrote essentially what I just said to you, that this was this happiest memory, blah, blah, blah. And he opened it and read it and hung the thing right away. And I knew he liked it. I knew he was touched by it. Maybe a year later, I was down at their house, and I happened to sit in his chair. And on the table, you know, his table by his chair, was that card. And it was completely, completely dog-eared. He must have picked that card up 10,000 times and read it. I knew that I was making amends. I knew it. He actually committed suicide a number of years later, a number of years ago now. And I went down to the hospital before he died, and he was in a coma. There was never a moment where I wished that he would wake up so I could say anything. I was totally 100% clean with my relationship with him. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt my amends were made. No question about it. You know, I used to think that that I lived my life the way that I did in such a promiscuous, awful manner because of the things that happened to me. I don't know if that's true or not. I honestly believe, you know, at this moment, subject to change at any moment, of course, that I live the way that I live because I'm selfish and self-centered, and I want to take my pleasure when I want to take my pleasure, you know. I believe today that I have love and compassion in my heart for him. I think that he was doing the best job he could with the tools he had to work with. I honest to God believe that to the core of my being. I am such a believer in making amends. I think that it is there's not a mistake that in the big book the promises come after the amends. That has been true for me, and I know for every other speaker that you've heard here this weekend that that's true. I think I've talked over my time. I'm going to sit down now, and Vince is going to just change the mood completely and make you all feel guilty about your financial amends. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Vince, and I am an alcoholic. And I am most happy to be here. I want to thank, my goodness, to be included in Murderer's Row. I'd like to thank I'd like to thank you for inviting me to the Bob Darrell Invitational. It's the august company. It indeed is an honor. I must say, you would not believe that a gentleman of my caliber would be married to a girl with such a tawdry story. She is the best part of me. Let me say that, God, I've heard so much this weekend that has been so wonderful. Everyone has been exquisite. And I just feel, I just love all of you. I really do. I love you. Which is not my usual talk, is it, Charlie? I mean, not really. But I feel that today. I am filled up. I think when I heard these steps read the first time, I was 23 years old. I was in the basement of a Presbyterian church in Long Beach, California. And I thought, good grief. It's this? This? I'm a product of the Roman Catholic Church. I'm a product of the Jesuits. I have read Aquinas and Augustine, and I am familiar with apologetics, and I can quote to you from Summa Theologica, the work of Aquinas, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that man's relationship with God is far more complex than this roomful of theologically illiterate Protestants can possibly imagine. I think it's very nice for you. I mean, it's quaint. And it's lovely that you all have this personal deity that you carry in your back pocket that gets you jobs and parking spaces and... But, I mean, stop it. Stop it. This is not my answer. And I know what you really mean. I know none of this is new. I mean, good grief. Personal moral inventory, really. We have a different name for that in my religious tradition. We call it examination of conscience. But it's precisely the same exercise. Admitting to God and to another human being the exact nature of your wrongs every Saturday afternoon from the time I'm 7 years old. I am familiar with this. This is not applicable to me. This simple pseudo-religious pap. And when you talked about... making a list of the people you had harmed, became willing to make amends. That's what you said, but it isn't what I heard. What I heard was, make a list of your sins and get ready for penance. And the next thing you told me was, now comes the penance. And in my case, it was not going to be seven Hail Marys. It was going to be radical because I had a lot of penance and a lot of atonement. And the only thing that would possibly atone for somebody with my life was I would have to go to a third world country, become some kind of a brother in a religious order, and maybe be an assistant to Mother Teresa in Calcutta and serve the poor. And maybe I would someday get even... Chuck Chamberlain, who's been mentioned here I don't know how many times this weekend, had a wonderful saying when he talked about amends. He said his job was to rub out the record. Rub out the record. And for me to rub out the record was going to be extraordinary. I would have to do... But it turns out that isn't what it says at all, is it? It says... It doesn't say penance, it says amends. And what that means is something far more horrible than Calcutta. It means I must repay the money. Oh, no. Not that. I owed $30,000 in personal debt. My family was, I was alienated from my family. I owed all of this money. And my first 2 years of sobriety were not fruitful with regard to any kind of, success. I was scattered and disjointed and lacked focus, but I managed to hang on. And I went to meetings every night, and I got and lost jobs that were preposterous. I mean, I first of all, my background is medical. I have a... let me say this. I come from this wonderful, lovely, glorious family with no other alcoholics in it. And they're Irish and Catholic, which is rank heresy, isn't it, in an AA meeting. But there aren't. I am the fifth child in a family of five children. I have four older sisters. And my youngest sister was 11 when I was born. My father was 50 and my mother was 45. And when I came along, the prince had arrived. I mean, I was spoiled. Just, my father was vice president of a railroad. We were privileged people. And I had this loving, wonderful family. So I don't, and I was cared for and loved and nurtured. They're all successful. They all finished and completed their education. They're all married to the same spouse forever. To give you an example, in the entire history of my family, as far as anybody can track back, there have been four divorces. Three of them are mine. So there is my relationship with my family. And when I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972 for the second time, and hopefully the last time, I'm living in Orange County and I'm trying to put life and limb together. I am educated. I went to four different Jesuit prep schools. That's a whole other evening. I was thrown out of one I was in every year. My family would get into them to get me into another one. But I ended up going to an Ivy League university, quit in the middle of my senior year in a rage because I, for the first time in my life, my family said no. So I was on a long weekend partying in Manhattan with a bunch of fraternity brothers. We got drunk. I wanted money to get back to school. They wouldn't send it to me, so I showed them I joined the Navy. I left an Ivy League university in the second semester of my senior year and joined the Navy. And while in the Navy, I received this medical education. I went through a program that was initially the very first physician assistant program. And I don't know if most of you out there know what a physician's assistant is or a PA, but I was one of the very early ones. And by hook or by crook, I'd lost that medical license in my drinking. And after I got out of the Navy, I was in private civilian medicine, lost the license. And this is the package I had in the fall, early fall of 1972. And there was no way to get that back. I was virtually unemployable. And I got and lost jobs that summer that were, that fall and winter of 1973 that were preposterous. I lost a job as a gas station attendant for being incompetent. I lost a job as a $1.87 an hour drill press operator in some hideous machine shop that was out of Dickens. You walked in there in the morning and sat on a stool and they wheeled a cart up with copper plates in it. And you took a copper plate and you put it under the drill and you pulled the handle and it put a hole in the middle of the copper plate. And then you took the copper plate and you put it over here. That was it. That was a job. I put the hole in the wrong place on about 1,000 of these copper plates. And the foreman, who was some Texan, said to me, "Son, we got to let you go, boy." He said, "I can see you're a real trier, but you're not bright enough to do this kind of work." And I said, "Bright enough?" I said, You redneck moron. Let me tell you, I'm a graduate of Cornell. By then I'd gone back and got my degree. I'm a graduate of Cornell University. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, "You ought to go on back there, boy, and take the course in drill press operating." And he was absolutely correct. And that's where I lived in 1972. In 1974, I was still sober. I was still floundering. I still lacked focus. I was able to pray. I've always prayed. There's never been a doubt about the existence of God, not with my background. I know that God exists. I can prove it to you intellectually. Anywhere from Aristotle with the theory of the first mover to Aquinas. God is there, I guarantee you. If you're new, trust me, he's there. You may not be on good terms, as I was not, but believe me, he's there. And But I couldn't focus. And in 1972, I finally relented to get a sponsor. Now, I don't recommend if you're new that you wait that long, but that's what happened to me. And the sponsor I got was somebody I knew who I had to ask. He was just a... And I put it off because I did not like him. He was a big charismatic speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. He went all over and he talked and he was famous and he was... But he was so arrogant, it seemed to me. And there was a way I could recognize that trait. By the way, I knew right away what that was. And he had this coterie of new people that I always go around with him and save his seat and get his coffee. And anyway, I had to ask him to be a sponsor. And he said, okay. He said, maybe I will. But you have to come up and have lunch with me in Los Angeles in this mission he ran on Skid Row. And so I went up and I had lunch with him and I asked him to help me. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, "I will help you on one condition, that you can accept the very simple proposition that your best judgment about your life is terrible, and that my judgment about your life is infinitely better than yours. And if you would be willing to do everything I suggest you do without debate, I will help you." Well, I was desperate that day. Just desperate enough to make that unholy pact with the devil. And I agreed to do that. And he had me do things like all of us have had this experience. Sponsors are, they lack understanding. They are uniform in that, aren't they? They don't really, because if you tell your sponsor, "Look, this is my problem," they then give you an answer that is a non sequitur. They then, if you give them a complicated issue, they give you a mundane, stupid answer, such as, I don't know how, I lost my medical license, I don't know how to make a living, I don't know how I can get it back, I owe all of this money, what should I do? Be at the meeting. Get on the coffee crew. Maybe you didn't hear me. You don't really understand. I'm addressing a real issue, not some moronic notion about making coffee. But these were the kind of answers that eventually helped me. Charlie was talking about that earlier. And eventually, this pragmatic, mundane, repetitive series of actions that you take in Alcoholics Anonymous that seemingly are unrelated to what you perceive your problem to be, and you turn around one day, and all of a sudden, of course, there are other little things that go along with that, like writing an inventory. All of the program. We get to the eighth and ninth step. I had amends to make that were not financial, many of them. I had to repair the relationship with my family, this huge family that had been destroyed, mostly in my mind, incidentally, and that's interesting. They never abandoned me, but I abandoned them because of shame and guilt. When I finally began to repair that relationship after several years of sobriety, I was discovered that they always loved me, and they always wanted me in their lives, even at my worst. but I was too ashamed to be in their lives. So we had a period of estrangement. But that relationship got repaired, and today it's a, boy, I am so happy to be connected to this wonderful, huge family. All of these sisters are now grandmothers, and I have nieces and nephews and grandnieces and grandnephews, and I'm Uncle Vin. And I'm kind of the patriarch, for God's sake. They call me and they say, you know, and how could that happen? But it has. And I paid the money back. And it wasn't easy. And I paid it back in small increments, as Pat's talked about. And I don't know how this happened, but I began to attract people who had trouble with finances, who were in terrible financial straits. And I don't know how that happened, but I know one day in my office, a young couple in our group came to see me. Their names were Brian and Nancy. And they picked me, I guess, because I was sober a while and I had a successful business and things seemed to be going well. And they said, we'd like to get some advice from you. And I said, anything I can do to help you, I will do. And they said, we think we may have some financial problems. And I said, well, why don't you tell me about that? And it turns out that they're living on credit cards. And when I say living on credit cards, I mean they're paying their rent on credit cards. They're going to the grocery store on credit cards. And they now have this mountain of debt. It hasn't come home yet because the credit cards are all new, a whole stack of them. But it's about to come, it's about to crash. And they know that. They can sense that. They're that perceptive. And I said, well, how do you make a living? What do you do? And Brian was a salesman. He sold franchises for the sales of cellular phones. Now, this was in the beginning of cell phones. And if you can follow that, I know it's a little convoluted, but that's what he did. And I said, Nancy, what do you do? And she said, I'm a realtor. I sell real estate. I said, well, that's wonderful. There was one problem. Brian never sold a franchise, and Nancy never sold any property. And I said, how much money have you made in, say, the last 6 months? And we totaled it up. It was $720. And I said, I have some information for you. Brian, you're not a salesman. We don't know what you are yet, but we're going to find out, but you're not a salesman. And Nancy, you are not a realtor. And I'll tell you how I know that. Because people who sell real estate actually sell it and other people give them money. That never happens to you. It's not an experience you're familiar with. You don't ever have that. And Brian, we're going to find out what you are, but you're not a salesman of franchises for cell phones. So I said, I will help you if you are willing to take my direction. And the first thing, they were living in a townhouse out in Encino at, I don't know, $2,100 a month that they paid for with a credit card. And I said, we're going to move you into the projects out by Clancy's house where the rent is $700 a month. And I'm going to loan you the $700 and you're going to pay me back someday, but you can put me last on the list. And then we're going to tackle this problem about who you are and how to live. And the first thing I did is I got a copy of the LA Times and went through the ads. And I found Brian a job as an athlete, played softball and was a real jock. And we found a job in there as an assistant manager for a sporting goods store at $1,500 a month. And I said, Brian, here is a job. And I'll never forget what he said to me, because what he said to me has motivated me to work with people with financial problems and to do this work. Because what he said to me was, I can't take that job because I won't be able to cover my expenses. I said, Brian, if you take this job, I have wonderful news for you. You're going to get a $1,400 a month raise. And I said to Nancy, you're not a real estate salesman, Nancy. Not yet, anyway. And I want you to go to, this is one of the largest realty companies in Los Angeles. I said, I want you to go to Mr. Douglas, and I want you to tell him that you love real estate and you one day like to be a realtor, but you're not yet and you don't know how to be one, but you have expenses and you need a job. And would he give you a job, some kind of a clerical job in that realty company that pays a salary? And then, in the meantime, you can maybe someone will take you under their wing and teach you how to be a realtor. And she agreed right away. She said, I'll do anything. I'll do it. Brian, however, he took the job because he had to. He was in a corner. What could he do? He didn't want to. He wanted part of this. This job was beneath him. So Nancy went to John Douglas, and she got a job editing their newsletter for all of their offices all over Los Angeles. And it was a paying job, and she had a good attitude. Brian went home and went to bed. He got up late. He showed up late, if he showed up at all, and he didn't do his job, and he lost his job, and all of a sudden, their marriage came unglued. They went in two different directions. Nancy kept that job. A real estate agent grabbed her and became her mentor and taught her how to sell real estate, and she became a very successful realtor in Los Angeles. And Brian got drunk. And this really motivated me to do it because I began to realize the biggest problem in marriages, in Alcoholics Anonymous, is money. It's not sex. It is money. It is finances, and it is communication about those finances. So pretty soon more people came, and we started a class. We call it the finance class. And what it really is a class on financial sobriety, on how to live responsibly and ethically within your means and live this life. And so the class developed to where now, when I'm in town, it's on Sunday mornings, and we have 75 people that show up, and each of them has a teacher, someone who's been through the class, who's resolved their issues, began to pay off unsecured debt, and began to live within their means, and they now help other people to live within their means. And so it just builds on one another. I don't teach anymore because I'm beyond that now, you know. I show up and pontificate. I do that well. I'm very good at that. And we have many married couples. And what's really interesting about money and alcoholics is that the problems in relationships about money are not about money. Money, again, like alcohol, is only a symptom. They're about communication. They're about power. They're about who controls what. That's what they're really about. So married couples in the finance class have direction. We have a policy. You come to class, and we recommend how to handle your money. We tell you what to pay, what not to pay, how to handle creditors, what to do about that. And you are only allowed to talk with each other about your finances once a week outside the class. And when you do, you must sit down with your spouse, sit across from each other, hold your hands, and say, I love you. And then deal with your finances. It changes the entire perspective. You are able to approach this as a team, not as adversaries. And this seems to work, and so the class gets bigger. And I can tell you that our class has people in it who make over $2 million a year, and it has people in it who make $30,000 to $40,000 a year. And the problem is precisely the same. It is about behavior. It isn't about how much money you make. If you have this problem, you cannot possibly make enough money. There isn't enough money because it isn't about money. It's about trying to purchase comfort and peace of mind and happiness. And I will tell you, they are not for sale. You can't buy them. You can only get them by doing what everybody here this weekend has talked about. That's how you get peace and comfort and happiness in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't purchase it with money. Alcoholics have the most bizarre, they say things that are, what I really like is when people say to me things like, I have a negative balance. What in the hell is a negative balance? The correct answer is, you write bad checks. Repeat after me, I write bad checks. I am a criminal. I one day may go to jail. That's a typical exercise in our class. I am behind in my child support, but I want to go to the international convention. So it's important. I'm an alcoholic. I should have that experience. And you will say, well, it costs money to go to the international convention. And you don't have, how are you going to do that? Well, I'm going to spend the money. But you don't have the money. You're not spending your money to go to the international convention. You're spending their money. You're spending your child's money. You're spending the support money. So I think it's all about primarily, and I had to learn this more than anybody in our class, it's how to grow up. And that's what I think our class is about. And I think that's what this whole issue is about. It's about maturity. It's about growing up. It's about fulfilling your responsibilities. I didn't always do it, but I'll tell you what this class has done for me. I do it now because I can't do something, I can't not do something that I have other people do. So my bills are all paid. I have no unsecured debt. I have a very good wife, too, I might add, who, in every relationship, in every marriage, there's somebody who's usually a little bit better at taking care of the finances than the other person. And I'll tell you what I have found in our class. It's usually the woman. I know you guys don't like to hear that. But it's usually the woman. Not always, but usually. And so, but it has to be together, but one person can write the checks. In my house, it's Pat. Pat Yo writes the checks. I know where the money's going, but she writes the checks. And so that's what the finance class is all about, and I guess that's what financial sobriety is all about. And I just want to say that I can't thank you enough for having us here. It's been a wonderful experience, and I look forward to the rest of the... I must say, I was struck by Tom last night. He is one of the giants in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the... there aren't many left. I don't want to scare you. But we're losing them. But he's one, and he's here. And what he said at the first 10 minutes of his talk last night made me want to get up and give him a standing ovation. All of this stuff, I think you can fall into a. He referred to it as a velvet trap, and I can't think of a better term to describe. You cannot, if you want to come here and live in the. Live in the book and in the steps and in step meetings and in study and in school. And it's very seductive because nobody can hurt you in there. You can live there forever. But if you take this and you take it outside into the world and you live your life by these principles and you spend maybe less time examining them and more time exercising them. And that for me has been the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Bob, for inviting us, and God bless everybody.
If we could go ahead and close with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, Amen.